Wisconsin has a wonderful diversity of landscapes. We kind of talked about that a little bit yesterday when we took when we visited about our first residents of Wisconsin, our native populations who were our first residents. Well, today we're going to zero in with you today a bit about our Ice Age history and a couple of guests who are back to visit with us again. John Attig is co-author of Roadside Geology of Wisconsin. That came up yesterday, as a matter of fact, I believe, in our discussion at one point or another, as a book that that you ought to have a look at. And he it's published by Mountain Press, a publishing company. He's affiliated with the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. He's also a professor of environmental sciences at UW-Madison. John, welcome back.
Hi, Larry. Good to see you.
Good to see you. And Dave Mickelson is our other guest today. Dave is an emeritus professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, recently published Glacial Landscapes of Dane County, another great publication. And we're glad to have you with us, Dave, as well. Thanks for coming by. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Yeah, and help if I turned your microphone on. There, now I think I have it. Now I think I have it on. So as we talk about the geology of the state, the history of the state, I hope you'll join in with some questions. We've got a number for you to call. It's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And, you know, as we look at our landscape, we've got such a diversity of landscapes here in the States, with the lakes in the north and the rolling farmland of eastern Wisconsin. And I guess we have the sand plains. And a lot of that's due to the glaciers.
Yeah, it sure is. Anyone who travels around the state, you'll see that from place to place, the landscape looks very, very different. You mentioned the northern part of the state, the Northwoods. Probably one of the things that stands out to most people is all the lakes and wetlands. Other parts of the state are very flat or very rolling. Some places the hills are very prominent. Some places are very subdued. As you know, the southwestern part of the state is very hilly, has really deep river valleys. And all of those are a result of the different geologic history, especially the glacial history of many parts of the state.
Dave Mickelson, how many times has Wisconsin been glaciated?
Well, we really don't know. It could be as many as 12 or even 15. We know there were a number of times when glaciers formed in Canada. They didn't make it far enough south to get into Wisconsin. But basically, every time a glacier comes down, it erodes away the deposits from previous glaciations. So we're sort of looking at a long book with most of the pages torn out. So it's hard to say that.
And how do we date them? Is that hard to know how many were here? How do you even date them?
Well, there are some deposits that we know are older than the last glaciation in the southern part of the state, in Rock and Walworth County, and also up in the central part of the state, Wood, Marathon County, in that area. We don't know how old those glaciations are. We know they're older because the soils are different. They've been on the surface much longer than the deposits of the last glaciation. We don't. No way we can put numbers on. We can only put numbers really on the timing of the last glaciation.
And the timing of the last was, what was the timing of the last?
The last glaciation, which, by the way, is referred to as the Wisconsin glaciation because the glacial landscapes are so prominent here. We think the ice advanced into Wisconsin by about 26,000 years ago. And the last ice receded from the north shore of Wisconsin into Lake Superior around 10,000 years ago. And at that time, the ice extended down roughly from Chippewa County. The edge of it was from Chippewa County over to Langlade County, and then south down into reaching the eastern end of the Baraboo Hills and down to Janesville.
Now, when the ice came, how far? I mean, it's amazing to me to think about rock and boulders and all the things that might have been pushed from other areas of the world, Canada primarily, I suppose. But how far Have we found rocks in southern Wisconsin that were from central Canada or something like that?
Well, it's there are some rock types you can look at and say exactly where they came from. And we have one rock you see a lot in around Dane County. We often refer to it just among ourselves as driveway rock because because people use it so much for landscaping. And it's a real kind of distinctive pinkish rock. It has grayish-blue to gray little specks in it. You see it in rock walls. And that rock definitely came from at least as far as the Keweenaw Peninsula and Michipicoten Island. And that layer of rock extends over into Canada at Mamay's Point. And so that's one rock we can say definitely came from at least as far as the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. The problem is that most rock types, let's say you find a nice piece of gray granite or something, that can have a source in many places. So it's very difficult to say exactly where that came from. But we definitely have rocks that came from as far as the Lake Superior area.
Do we have an idea of the depth of the ice as it came through? I mean, how thick are we talking about here, Dave Mickelson?
Well, it probably had a really steep front on it. So here in Madison, for instance, where we're only 6 to 10 miles away from where the ice ended, the ice was probably 800 feet thick, say, over the Capitol building.
Boy.
By the time we get up to Green Bay, it probably was at least a half mile thick, maybe somewhat thicker. And by the time we get up to the Hudson Bay region, it could have been about two miles thick.
Oh, my gosh. It's hard to imagine, isn't it?
Yep.
And also you have to remember that that whole mass of ice wasn't just sitting there, it was moving. And it's that motion of ice that really was so important in forming the glacial landscapes.
So as the ice froze in the north, it sort of pushed the front of the ice, the front end, south.
Well,
is that how it worked, or is it?
As the ice, you know, ice behaves differently under different pressure conditions.
Okay.
So, you know, you've dropped an ice cube on the floor, you know, it just shatters.
Yeah.
But once it's under a thickness of about 100 feet of ice, then it behaves much more like room temperature tar or really cold molasses. Flows slowly. It doesn't crack. It flows. And so as the thickness of the ice built up in Canada, the lower ice started to move, started to flow, and then it's just a matter of gravity moving
pushing
the ice away from the high part of the ice out toward the edge.
Oh, man. John Adig and Dave Mickelson, our guests today, as we talk with them about the geologic history of our Badger State. If you would like to join in, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about the Driftless area for a bit. I'm sure most of us have, many people have heard that term, Driftless area. What is it? And turn to you, John Addie.
Well, if you drive westward from Madison towards the Mississippi River, you shortly realize you're driving in a very different landscape. You're driving in a landscape that, rather than the rolling topography of the Madison area, you're driving in these really deep river valleys.
Yeah.
And the Driftless area is essentially the area of Wisconsin where, as far as we know, it has never been glaciated. And Driftless, the term refers back to, the term drift used to be kind of a general term that was used to refer to any kind of deposits the glaciers left behind. And early on, that area was referred to as the Driftless area because there was no evidence of glaciation. In more recent years, there's actually been some evidence of glaciation discovered around the margins of the Driftless area, but we certainly believe that at least for hundreds of thousands of years and perhaps much longer, probably millions of years, it's been basically a landscape formed by rivers and by the cold climates that accompanied the Ice Age. So even though it wasn't covered by glaciers, many features of the landscape in the Driftless area are really attributable to the cold climate that accompanied the ice sheets.
The ice sheets. Well, it's a beautiful area. And Dave, you wanted to add something there.
I was just going to say that the landscape is different there, but we also know it wasn't glaciated because we don't have these rocks that have been carried a long distance by the glacier. They're called erratics, and they don't exist in the Driftless area. Except for the ones that are being hauled out there by landscapers today. So the next generation may have trouble convincing people that it wasn't glaciated.
Dan in Appleton has a question or comment. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. I drive a delivery kind of a route, so I go through a big section of the state all the way from Appleton out to Medford and then back through Anago and back down again. So I started to see a lot of these different landscapes around and started to think about them a lot myself. And I did have a couple questions, one being, when you're moving, like, say, east to west, and how can you tell the difference between what is recessional type of moraines and terminal moraines? Because particularly when you go out west of Waupaca and you go through there and Amherst, and obviously it drops off almost suddenly, you know, as you get to Stevens Point, because I know that's where it was a glacial lake there. But how can you tell really kind of which ones are which? Because, I mean, are always the terminal ones very hilly or whatever?
Well, the general term terminal moraine just means it's the moraine deposited during the maximum extent of the glaciation. So in that area, if you're driving, for instance, across on Highway 21.
Or 10, yeah.
Okay, well, so let's be a little further south on 21, you get just 2 or 3 miles west of Coloma. And you just almost precipitously drop off the moraine out onto the flat sand plain.
Right.
It's a little more confused as you go east from Stevens Point because there are several river valleys that sort of come together along the margin of the glacier. But there again, you see this. You're basically on a fairly flat to gently rolling surface, and suddenly the landscape gets much more hilly. One thing you really notice is all of a sudden you get a lot more hardwoods because the soils change. So that's the edge of the terminal moraine. Then as you continue eastward on any of those roads, what you see is you kind of go across, you'll go across a highland, and then you'll drop down onto a flat area, a flattish area, and then you'll go across another little highland. Each one of those little highlands you cross is a recessional moraine.
Oh, okay.
And so those were just deposited as the glacier shrunk back into the Green Bay lowland.
Boy, with the job that you have, I tell you what, Dan, you should be taking a look at John's book called The Roadside Geology of Wisconsin. It's something that would fit right in your vehicle, and I think it'd be extremely helpful to you.
I go about 300 miles every day around the same route. So I started to, as I kind of started thinking about it, I'm going, this is interesting, and that's interesting, and I started digging around a little bit. So it's pretty, it's really, really fascinating subject. I did have one other quick question. One other area I go through is right near, of course, it's through Tigerton and Wittenberg and that area. Is those all glacial deposits? Because I know most of them in the ground, because I know the earth is largely full of rocks. In a couple of places, obviously, it looks like a field of rocks.
Yeah, the terminal moraine there is right near Ringel. Ringel or Hatley.
Then
as you go east, it's the same sequence of a terminal moraine near Ringel and Hatley, and then as you go further east, there's a whole series of recessional moraines. But that area, you see all of those really large blocks of kind of a reddish granite sitting in the landscape. And that's because right in that area, there's a large mass of rock called the Wolf River Batholith. And it's made up of a red granite that tends to have fractures in it that are sort of 1 to 2 yards apart. And so when the glacier came over, what it did is it was quarrying that rock, basically, and then spreading it out.
And we can talk some more about that in just a few minutes. John Attic and Dave Mickelson, our guests here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the geology of Wisconsin today with a couple of guests. I'm Larry Mueller, John Attig, co-author of The Roadside Geology of Wisconsin. One of our guests today, the other, Dave Mickelson, Emeritus Professor of Geology and Geophysics at UW-Madison. He recently published The Glacial Landscapes of Dane County, and he's also working on another book, The Geology of the Ice Age Trail, and that's one that will certainly be featuring when he finishes that book as well. It's a UW Press book, so about halfway through with that, but we'll get him on to talk about that later. Right now, though, it's the geology of Wisconsin, and we're zeroing in a little bit on the glaciers, but we will take your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or email at talk@wpr.org. And Dave Mickelson, I know you wanted to go back. We had a comment relating to red granite And I know you wanted to add something to that.
You know, John was mentioning the red granite boulders that we see up in the area east of Stevens Point, east of Wausau. And I was just going to say that we think those represent a fairly long period of weathering that took place long before glaciation. And when the glacier came over, it was not eroding hard rock, but it was eroding this fairly thick layer of partly weathered granite. And that weathered granite is what people in the central part of the state call rotten granite. They use it for highways and so on, and it's exposed here and there all around Marathon County and a little to the north and south.
Alex in Shawnee County, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Alex.
Hello. I've been waiting for this program. Say, I'm a potter here in Shawnee County, and I wash the glacial till illite clays out to make pottery the last 30 years.
Okay.
And I have a puzzle about where this clay actually came from. I have a theory that the glacier ground down the Makotika shale and mixed that all up, and that's what the glacial till clays are, or did they come from somewhere else?
Dave Michelson, what do you think?
Well, certainly the glacier does a lot of grinding, but very often the glacier isn't grinding things all the way down to the clay size. Some of it gets that small, but if it's really clay, then a lot of it was existing in the environment and in the sedimentary rocks the glacier was going over, and it's being re-released. But the way clay has gotten concentrated in the glacial deposits that we see up in Shawnee County and all over eastern Wisconsin and also up in Douglas, Bayfield, Ashland counties, that clay was concentrated in the lake basin. Then when the glacier came down, it was picking up the clay and spreading it across the landscape and depositing it as glacial till.
All right.
Another question.
Sure.
This glacial till clay, after I washed out, it's about 10% free calcium carbonate. And when I acid wash this calcium carbonate out, the characteristics of that washed clay is just like the Makotika shale clay. So I'm assuming it's illite. Is that true?
Well, illite is, at least in the till in eastern Wisconsin, typically yes. Illite is the dominant clay mineral. But it... Some of it may be from the Makokita Shale, but there are also shales in the Lake Michigan Basin, northern part of the Lake Michigan Basin, that may be contributing. That would be
so this glacial till clay could be just about anything the glacier hauled down here.
Exactly.
Okay. It adds to the puzzle, but
right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Chet in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Chet.
Hi, and thank you for such a wonderful program.
Thank you.
The reason I'm calling, I grew up on a dairy farm in southwestern Juneau County near the communities of Camp Douglas and Hustler, which were right on the Driftless area.
Yes.
My dad's dairy farm is, in fact, on top of a hill, and some of his land is down in the hill, which we always assumed was the bottom of Lake Wisconsin. I would like to know how the bluffs, Mill Bluff, Twin Bluff, so on and so forth, all those sandstone bluffs were formed. That's my first question. My second question is I would like to know how far those bluffs and my dad's farm was submerged below the ice sheet in the last glaciation. And then my third question is, on my father's farm, about halfway up the bluff, there was a large rock that was about the size of a 10-gallon milk can that the family always was told was a meteorite. We, in fact, had it broke a piece off and had it analyzed, and it was a piece of a stone from the north shore of Lake Superior that had been carried there by the glacier, which we thought was fascinating. Is that unusual? So I have three questions.
All right. Well, let's start out. John, do you want to start?
Well, I can start out a little bit about how those the mounds or the bluffs form. Those bluffs are remnants of layers of rock that used to extend across the whole central part of Wisconsin. And probably a long period of river erosion that we don't know too much about. Mm-hmm. But the final sculpting and shaping of those probably took part. Part of the steep-sidedness of them is probably the result of wave washing around their bases by a large glacial lake that occupied central Wisconsin. And I'll just as an aside, when the glacier advanced into southern Wisconsin, it came from the north and east, and it rode up onto the eastern end of the Baraboo Hills. And when it did so, it blocked the south-flowing Wisconsin River. So the central part of the state filled up with water up to an elevation of about 970 feet, and then it began, the water could drain out the East Fork of the Black River. So that large lake existed during the height of the glaciation, and those waves were, some of those mounds, the waves were lapping at the base of them, and you can find beach gravels around the base of some of those mounds.
Uh-huh. Very cool. Ice over the, how much ice might have been over, were you going to add something to that, Dave Michelson?
Well, I was just going to say that the dramatic flat surface that you see typically between those sandstone mounds is the lake bed. That's why it's flat. And we see similar rocks standing up in, all through the Driftless area. They don't show up as much because we have these deep valleys in between them.
Okay.
The dramatic up there because of that flat surface, like around Mill Bluff, and, of course, the interstate goes right across that landscape up there.
How much ice would have been over that area? Chet's wondering how much ice was over his dad's farm there up on that hill.
Well, yeah, the ice didn't extend that far, so that's okay. Part of the Driftless area. It was the low areas were covered by the glacial Lake Wisconsin, but those hilltops were not covered by ice.
Okay. And I think we got all the answered all your questions. There was one about a large rock. Oh, you covered.
Yeah, I'll mention that too. You mentioned the rocks that might be from Lake Superior, and there are dark rocks called basalt, very fine grained, fairly heavy, that is very common in the glacial deposits that came from Lake Superior. And there are some of these rocks carried by glaciers that are found out along the edge of where Glacial Lake Wisconsin was. Those floated on icebergs, probably. So even though it's Driftless area, there are a few glacially carried rocks.
And someone, just sort of a question, as long as we're talking about lakes and waters, Joe in Green Bay wondered if the Great Lakes were formed by the last glaciation or a previous glaciation, and wonders that.
Well, the Great Lakes were certainly in existence before the last glaciation, probably starting off as actually a river system that's just over many, many glaciations has been broadened and deepened to form the present lake basins. The modern Great Lakes, as we see them, certainly the location of the shorelines, the shape of the shorelines, the depth of the lake basins, as much of that is attributable to the last glaciation. But the locations of those big, broad basins is something that's evolved over many glaciations and a very long period of geologic time.
He wondered if the last glaciation, if Lake Superior froze completely, if it was frozen right to the bottom of the floor.
At when the glacier was at its maximum in Wisconsin and through the ice that flowed through the Superior Basin went down into Minnesota, the lake basin was completely full of glacial ice.
Okay.
But then as the ice retreated, Lake Superior today drains to the east. And that's where the glacier was as it was melting out of the area. So it dammed the water in the western part of the basin. It couldn't flow eastward. So as far as we know, it was never frozen. That water was never frozen to the bed. It was just like a lake today. It would freeze during the colder periods of the year. But it drained westward through the St. Croix River and into the Mississippi.
Let's turn to Mary in Eau Claire next. Mary, hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm very curious. I'm pretty sure I'm accurate in saying this, that there's only a certain amount of water on the face of the earth. And I'm wondering, as these glaciers were forming, how much water did they take out of the ocean? And what happened to the ocean level when these glaciers were forming? I'll take my answer off here.
All right. Thanks for calling. Dave Michelson?
Yeah, well, you're certainly correct that all the ice in the ice sheets was formed from water taken from the oceans. And the oceans at the height of the last glaciation were a little over 300 feet lower than they are today. So that along the east coast of the U.S., for instance, the edge of the ocean would have been out at the edge of the continental shelf. And that continental shelf was dry ground, except for rivers going across it.
Wow.
So since the last glaciation, sea level has risen about 300 feet.
Boy, there you have it. Thank you, Mary.
One nice direct piece of evidence of that is it's not that uncommon for fishermen dragging the bottom out off the coast of Maine and the New England states to bring up bones of mastodons. or something. Some of the other Ice Age mammals that lived out on those, you know, what's now the continental shelf.
Oh, wow.
I should just follow up a little
sure,
bit
go right
more
ahead,
because I think a lot of people have heard about the concern about rising sea level because of the continued melting of glaciers. And, of course, that's just a continuation of what happened after the Ice Age maximum. And if the Greenland ice sheet melts away, if the Antarctic ice sheet loses a lot of volume, then sea level will continue to rise.
And could go up several more feet.
Could. During the last interglacial, the sea level was about 100 feet higher than it is today.
All right. 100 feet. Oof. That would take away...
Florida.
That would take away Florida. Yeah, that's for sure. Kurt in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Kurt.
Hello. Good morning. And thank you very much for most interesting... As a retired mechanical engineer, I traveled throughout Wisconsin, and I always wished I would have known more about what I'm seeing there, about the different geological situations. I was wondering if it is possible that maybe in the tourist centers, as people come into Wisconsin, and Wisconsin likes to encourage tourism, there may be some material of this nature, maybe on a little lower level, more popular level. It may interest a tourist. It may detain him in Wisconsin for a little longer, which we all would like. And finally, I would just like to say that I just finished a wonderful book called Driftless, written by a Wisconsin man by the name of David Rhodes. It gives you both a novel as well as some of the explanation of geological situation in that area. The name of the book is Driftless.
All right. And John Attig, you are nodding your head like you know that book.
Well, I just wanted to first make a comment about the tourism. There are many places in Wisconsin that... kind of base a tourism industry, at least in part, on the landscape and the glacial history. There are places that really focus on the Ice Age Trail. You see that a lot up in the northern part of the state. Taylor County comes to mind in the Medford area and right away. And I just want to, there are some good sources of information that people who are traveling around the state can go to. I mean, you've mentioned some books, but you could also go to the Wisconsin Geological Survey's website. It's wisconsingeologicalsurvey.org. And you'll see there's information there about glacial landscapes with a lot of links to materials that have been prepared by many different people. And one thing we have tried to do over the years, although we always wish we could do more than we have, is we've tried to prepare materials for state parks and the DNR naturalists and other people who deal with people coming to visit the state on a daily basis.
And, yeah, go ahead, Dave Michelson.
Well, a couple of other things that people might want to look at. The Ice Age Alliance has a website with a lot of information about that, and the National Park Service also has information about the Ice Age Trail and also the Ice Age Scientific Reserve that's in Wisconsin.
All right. Thanks very much, Kurt. Appreciate your call. Doug in Eau Claire, we're on to you now. Hi, Doug.
Hello, Larry. Yeah, good topic. I had a kind of a technical question, and I just wanted to get the guest's opinion on this, or it's kind of a comment, I guess. I studied, I'm a geologist in a prior life, I guess, and the way I learned how glaciers work, they don't really push material. There's a velocity gradient up and down and side to side, vertically and horizontally, as it were. And the glaciers actually entrain material into the detritus and bedrock right into the glacier. And because of the velocity gradient, which is slower on the bottom, and it as you go up into the glacier, it gets faster, and this works both as I say horizontally and vertically. The material is brought up and then deposited in medial moraines and lateral moraines and so on and so forth. Is this right? I mean, this is many years ago, but I just kind of like to get a comment on the mechanics of how the glaciers move the material.
Sure. Let's turn to Dave Michelson.
Well, you're right. It's not as very much a bulldozing process. What's happening at the bottom of the glacier is that there are places where freezing on is taking place. So water and the grains of sediment or rocks are actually being frozen onto the bottom of the glacier. So if you go to many modern glaciers, you see a layer that's maybe a few feet thick to 10 or 20 feet thick. There's a lot of debris in the glacier, and that's where most of the material gets transported. It places, especially near the edge of the glacier, that material can be brought up to the ice surface. And John may want to comment on how that influences the topography, especially in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'll just say that, you know, whenever we've mentioned moraine several times, and at least in northern Wisconsin, we have these areas that mark the edge of where the ice stood, these moraines that are broad, they're kilometers wide, they're often several hundred feet high, and they tend to be very hilly. And what happens is where the ice is standing still for any period of time, you're just getting more and more material from the base of the ice stacked up. Because the reason the edge of the glacier is staying in one place is that you have an equilibrium between the amount of melting that's going on and the amount of ice that's flowing into the area. So you just continue to stack up material. And then over time, you build up just a thickness of ice and rock. And as the ice eventually melts out, it just leaves a very, what we refer to as hummocky. It's our word for hilly, but we tend to use the word hummocky. And if you want to see that process happen, you can see it any spring at the end of your driveway. Just look at the plowed up pile where you have rock and sand, and you'll see what happens is, as it melts out, you just end up with a really irregular little surface of rock and sand. And it's exactly the same process in a microcosm.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. Thank you, Doug. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Bill in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thank you for this good program. I've always wondered why the glacier split over Wisconsin and left the unglaciated area that I'm familiar with.
All right. That's a good question as well. Dave Michelson, turn to you first.
Well, there's been quite a few ideas over the years, but I think we're convinced now that the reason is mainly controlled by topography. You know, when the glacier was coming out of Canada into the Lake Superior Basin, it was hitting that east-west trending basin that's deep. Lake Superior is 900 feet deep. So the ice had to get across that basin and then over the upland in northern Wisconsin. And that just retarded the flow of the ice enough. Much of the ice that was coming down there was diverted over into Minnesota or eastward and then down the Lake Michigan basin.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling. And Ray in Merrimack. On to you. Hi, Ray.
Hi, guys. I will just go driving through Lake Lake Flambeau, and I've got John's book, and I've been using it all week. And matter of fact, when we came back from the ferry ride to Madeleine Island last night, I forgot the book. And we had to run down and get out of Lost and Town this morning. But we're really enjoying it and what you have in on Madeleine Island and the whole works. And every time I travel to Wisconsin, I've got that book with me.
Well, you know, that's great. And to explain for those who aren't familiar with your book, John, the Roadside Geology of Wisconsin.
Well, it's a book that's written for people that don't deal with geology every day, but who are interested in knowing about the geology and the land that's around them. It's divided up into a number of chapters that deal with five different regions of the state, and it talks about what you see as you drive down certain roads. And we picked the roads where we thought you could see the best examples of things and things that you could see as you're driving along. It didn't require a lot of detailed study. And that's one thing I should mention, that when you look at glacial landscapes, when we look at glacial landscapes when we're studying them, we have a lot of tools at hand that not everyone has. We have a lot of aerial photography. We have very detailed maps. We have different types of satellite and plane image, fixed-wing aircraft imagery. So, you know, when you're driving down a road, often something that just looks like a hill as you're driving down the road, if you have a map or a photo or something in hand, you see a different and a regional picture. All the hills might be lined up, for instance, by the flow of the ice, or you see these distinct ridges that the glacier deposited. So that's why if you go to website, like I mentioned earlier, at the Geological Survey, or you get some of the different materials that Larry and Dave have mentioned, it really helps as you're driving down a road to picture what went on in the landscape that you're driving through.
I would definitely agree with that, and I want to thank you guys so much for being with us today. The time flew by. Well, I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Be happy to.
Enjoyed it.
Love to have you back again. John Addick, co-author of Roadside Geology of Wisconsin, published by Mountain Press Publishing. He wrote that book with Bob Dott. It's a wonderful book, and I certainly recommend it to you. Dave Michelson, Emeritus Professor of Geology and Geophysics at UW-Madison. He's published The Glacial Landscapes of Dane County and is working on a book of the geology of the Ice Age Trail. And we'll be talking with him when that book comes out as well. And we'll have these guys back and do it again. Thanks to everybody who listened in today. And I want to say thanks to the, I think, close to 500 listeners who've already donated to our Take Days Off campaign. For every 700 donations, we'll take one day off our fall pledge drive. And we're close to taking a day off now. Not quite there yet. But if you haven't donated, go to WPR.org to donate right now and help us take those days off. We'd love to take a few of those days off. And you can help us, WPR.org. Just to let you know, tomorrow we'll talk consumer protection issues. Jim Packard filling in for me with Janet Jenkins. And then we'll also have a visit with Jill Gilbert, Welly Talk, and patents. Stay with us.